experience it for the first time, just looking at it and going, whoa.
We might catch kittens.
They're running around, they're getting so much exercise. I've watched them going back and forth and back and forth. They're probably covering kilometres.
Although we live nearby, we haven't been to the domain for ages. And I see them enjoy it. They played for a long time, they are excited, they want to do more. It's awesome.
I think it's brilliant, especially for the autistic. Cameron's 9, he's not one that will go out, socialise. Today we've seen him interacting with other children, which is brilliant, and exercise.
I think it's something they should spread more Auckland-wide, more local area parks would be a great idea. We have a park just around the corner, and if there was something like this there, it would be so much easier for the kids to run down there and have a play around.
Hello and welcome. I'm Melanie Langlotz from GUAR Games, the CEO. What you just saw was the world's first digital playground called Magical Park. Today we're going to take you on a journey of how we actually ended up challenging Pokemon Go, our journey as a startup, and yeah, how it all happened. And some of you guys may be closet entrepreneurs and get inspired, hopefully. So let's start with Magical Park. So Magical Park is a digital playground which we're offering to councils. So imagine councils are subscribing to turn a park into a playground. And in order to give you a bit of a background as to how this all happened, so as I said, I'm Melanie Langlers, the CEO, responsible for sales and marketing. I have a background of 20 years in the film and television industry. And one of the things that I noticed during this time was that the audience was shifting. Especially kids weren't consuming entertainment anymore the way we do. And so I was looking for, you know, what would be the next type of entertainment format? What would come next? So I have a little stepdaughter, and back then she was 7. It was 2011, and I signed up to study entrepreneurship. And as you may know, entrepreneurship always starts with what's the problem that you want to solve and what's the solution. So as I was thinking about my background, my research of trying to figure out what the next entertainment format was going to be, I also noticed how frustrated I was because I couldn't get her outside. She was only 7, and she said to me, playing outside is boring. I much rather play mobile games and be on my laptop. I don't want to go outside. So I realized that if I could come up with a solution, other parents would probably pay for it because I would. And I got really interested in augmented reality and started researching. So this all started in 2011.
Right, I think that's me. I'm Amy. I'm the technical co-founder, although I started off in law. I'm actually a brand new programmer. I only graduated in 2015. I was lucky enough to land a job at Orgview, where I met Mel. And I got a lot of experience working with augmented reality there. I'm a long-time gamer, so I've been playing computer games for as long as I can remember. I don't know how many of you right now are playing Legion, but that's my current obsession. If anyone's looking for a tank, Nagrand server. So today we'll be taking you through, like Mel said, our journey, how we started off and how we ended up with a product that is being called the product that's challenging Pokemon Go.
So Orgview. Amy and I met at Orgview, and Orgview is a startup that uses geospatial augmented reality to make underground infrastructure visible to road workers. It's a pretty amazing concept, and we had the privilege to learn for 3 years everything we know about geospatial augmented reality at this particular startup. Now, in order, before we kind of like rush in and explain to you the difference, how we're different to Pokemon Go, because that's most of the time the key question people ask us, I'm going to get Amy to just talk you through the main differences of augmented reality.
All right, so you probably are familiar with AR, at least some forms of AR. The most common form is image recognition. So you hold up a camera, it recognizes an image, and it responds with some digital content that has been programmed to appear once that image is recognized. And that sort of AR has been around for a long time. Moving a little bit forward from that, we've got spatial augmented reality, and that places augmented reality or places digital content in the space around you. So that's what a lot of the current headsets are doing, HoloLens, Magic Leap, they're all looking at putting things in the world around you. Geospatial augmented reality is a form of spatial augmented reality that doesn't look at the particular physical environment, but instead looks at your GPS coordinates, and it will put digital information around you based on your GPS location. So that's what we do. We do geospatial augmented reality. To make it work, you need a device that's got GPS. You need a device that's got sensors to be able to tell how you're holding your device, so accelerometer, gyroscope, magnetometer. And using all of this, we can drop a digital world into a physical space like a park, and kids are able to walk around and explore that.
Cool. So what is actually the difference? So how many of you guys, if I can see a show of hands, have played Pokemon Go? A few of you. Awesome. Cool. Fantastic. So let's say you're out there and you see Pikachu and you want to catch Pikachu. The thing is, when you see him, you're always the same distance away from it. You're not able to walk up closer, let alone you're not able to walk around him. You can't interact with it. It will always do the same thing that it does every time you catch it, right? Well, for us, it's quite different. And in order to show you how our games work, I'm going to run a little video and talk over the top of it. So here, this is our game Sharks in the Park, which was the first one we started. The objective of this game is to catch as many fish as you can and run away from the shark. And as you can see, we use mobile devices just like everybody else. You can see your surroundings through the device. Most of the family of the households actually have a device that is suitable. Here you see an old version of Sharks in the Park, and the player runs through a virtual world. He can explore everything that is in that virtual world around him. We use park spaces because they are safer. Safety is very important to us. If a child drops a device, it doesn't break because it falls on grass. What we've also found is that our type of games are very social. Kids like to play together. And as you saw as well. So safety is very important to us, as I said. So we've got a fence in there. So if you're walking 15 meters into a road or close to a road, it will literally bring up the stop sign and that's it. And you're told to kind of turn around and walk away. Back to Orgview, our journey.
Back to Orgview. So Orgview was an amazing experience for us. It was a startup that had received a reasonable amount of investment. So entering that team, we had around about 10 staff at any one time, and Mel and I were given a lot of leeway and flexibility in our job to help create a really great startup. With every startup, there's always risks and there's always unknowns, and with Orgview, we weren't sure about a lot of things. We were working in the utility industry. It's a notoriously slow-moving industry, and we were trying to inject new technology into that industry. As it turned out, Orgview needed to downsize. It wasn't taking off as fast as it had hoped. It's still around, but unfortunately, Mel and I were made redundant. I actually made us redundant as part of my job, so that was a little bit unfortunate for us. But Mel had redundancy insurance, and I was able to keep myself on at Orgview for a few months part-time, so that's how we were able to start GeoAR Games.
Yeah, and so obviously now comes the big thing, you want to know your co-founder. I would not be on this journey if it hadn't been for Amy, because I'm not a programmer. My coding experience goes as far as HTML, and that's it. But I'm a visionary, and I have ideas, and I had researched my idea for a long time. And Amy came to me as this whole redundancy conversation came up and said, I really like your idea, let's do it, now is the time. And I thought, yeah, absolutely. We had worked together for 3 years, we felt we knew each other pretty well. Well, guess what? Fact is that when you're walking into a startup with your co-founder, you realize that it's like a marriage. You're in a relationship, and every investor will tell you that you're potentially in it for 10 years. So think about that. Now, we thought we knew each other pretty well. Turned out we didn't. Well, actually not as well as we thought, you know. For starters, so we're very, very different. We're literally like, you know, yeah, complete opposites. I give you an example. So, for instance, Amy is really, really structured. She is a really amazing developer. She loves writing documents and documenting everything and putting them into neat little folders and writing every decision down. And here am I, and everything happens in my head, right? And so when we're making decisions, I have to kind of like think out loud and have conversations about it, which is really really confusing. Versus, as I said earlier on, Amy really likes to kind of like write decisions down, and then she, being a programmer, would like to have analytical research as to how we came up with the decision, whereas I am very often going by my gut instinct because we're pushed for time. Other than that, of course, you know, like she's introverted, I'm extroverted. I like to kind of, you know, start working ideally at lunchtime and work until late in the night, you know, sometimes until 4 a.m, versus Amy starts at crack of dawn and, you know, goes to bed reasonably early. So we're really, really different. But, you know, that also has got its benefits.
Yeah, it does. And as much as Mal says she wouldn't be here without me, there's no way I would be here without her. The tenacity and the motivation and the drive that she has and the visions that she has, those are things that every co-founder needs to some extent, but I don't have that, and I wouldn't have been pulled through this far through the journey if she hadn't been towing me behind her a lot of the way. And talking about being co-founders being sort of like in a marriage, we'll talk about this a bit further on as well, but we did Lightning Lab and Accelerator, and we actually shared a bedroom for, 3 to 4 months? I tell you, you think you know someone, you don't, until you share a bedroom with them. But it's working out really well, and I think our open communication and the style that we've approached this with, knowing that we're so different, has actually made a huge difference to the success of our working relationship.
So what is really important here is that when you're starting a startup, you have to kind of like learn how to manage conflicts. And for us, we have very strict communication rules, and I think they followed us through the culture from Overview as well. So our rule is that whenever we have opposite opinions is that we think about it as the other person, whatever they have done, whatever, you know, like they're thinking that we disagree with, has come from a place of only wanting the best for the company and for us. This is the basis of every conversation that we're having, that there is an understanding that whatever Amy kind of like thinks of, whatever I think of, is always in the best interest of the company and of us both. So when we sense that there is an issue or a disagreement, we don't wait to kind of like discuss it. It straight away is being brought up in a very good, effective manner without obviously yelling and screaming. This is the whole difference between being reactive to being response-able. And we also look at our values, and the values are really important because the values in a startup are shaping the culture. You have to start to shape the culture early. And so our company culture is made up of both of our values. I will say a little bit more about that later on, because Amy's values really shaped the brand. Amy is very ethical, she's got a very strong moral compass, and versus I'm, for instance, you know, more money-driven because I'm older than her and I have other responsibilities and I needed to have financial security. So, you know, that can clash at times. So I will tell you a little bit more about that later on.
Right, funding. Startup is great fun, but nobody pays you to run a startup. And until you have a product that's making money, you have no customers who are also not paying you, so you've got to figure out a way how you're going to survive. Normally that's maybe savings, or maybe you have a part-time job, or maybe you have a supportive partner. There's all sorts of different ways, but you need to have some sort of cash to start with. So Accelerator, the startup community is growing all the time, and it's really amazing to watch it take off. Over the last 5 years, the number of accelerators which are popping up that support new startups has been rapidly increasing, and there are hundreds of them now. New Zealand has around about 10, I think, now, and they've just started a new one this year. So there are lots of opportunities with accelerators if you have an idea and you want to see if it will, if you can make it happen. So traditionally, accelerators will run you through a mentorship program of 3 to 4 months. They will give you some seed funding, normally around about $20,000, but it can be anywhere up to sort of $100,000 and $150,000. And you will get intense mentoring and advice, often ending with a demo day where you then get the opportunity to pitch your product to a bunch of investors and see if you can then get investment to go off and scale your business and grow it how you have planned.
So, we started GeoAR Games in September 2015. And the first 2 months, Amy and I just went around to loads of contacts that I had in the industry and just asking them for advice. We were trying to validate our idea as much as we could and try and shape a little bit more what the vision was. And during all those meetings for 2 months, we also talked to Stephen Knightley, who some of you guys may know because he started the New Zealand gaming industry. He's known for the founder of NZGDC. And Stephen said to us, why don't you apply for S-Factory? And we were like, what the heck is that? It's like, it's an incubator, a business incubator. And we were like, well, what do we do in a business incubator? We didn't even have a clue that they existed, let alone what would happen there. But anyway, we trusted Stephen, and so we applied.
Right. I appear not to be prepared for this slide.
No, I can talk to it. So basically, S-Factory is basically a incubator where you get $15,000 for no equity, which is really unusual. So imagine that. And have I got the right text, actually? Yeah. And so basically what happened was that when I told my friends and family that, you know, like we were applying for an incubator that was giving us $15,000 for no equity, they all said to me, it's a scam. It absolutely must be a scam. Nobody's going to give you free money and not that much. No way. And then where is it? And I said, well, it's in South America. Oh, no way. You're going to go over there. You get kidnapped. You get killed. Don't do it. So I had a lot of people around me who said, please don't do it, this is crazy, to the point where I even rang up the embassy and I said, can you tell me, have you ever heard of S-Factory? And I said, no. So I was even more nervous. But anyway, we applied, and it wasn't until we got the letter back with the confirmation that it was actually going ahead and that I had 4 weeks literally to show up in Chile and get my visa sorted and everything else. That I realized it was legit, and it was actually a subsidiary of a very famous incubator, which is called Startup Chile. And I think at that point, I'm probably going to get you to talk a little bit more about that. Is that still me?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Awesome. So basically, I had 4 weeks time to get my visa sorted, to get my criminal record checkup, to get everything sorted, pack up my life, and tell my partner, hey, bye, I'm off to Chile for 3 months, see ya. And and it was really, really nerve-wracking, and there was pretty much no time to really think. But what I also learned was that S-Factory had some really interesting terms and conditions, and so I'm going to tell you those now for those who are really drawn in by the no equity thing and the free money. So, S-Factory only pays for 84 days, but you're expected to be there for 4 months. They also expect you to cover 10% of the expenses. Because this is a government fund, there is a very strict auditing system at the end where you basically have to show, you know, how you've spent the money. But it is a really, really, truly incredible opportunity because you're going to an international startup in Santiago in Chile. And in the end, you know, like it's free money. So, yeah, so here's just quickly the rundown again. So it's 3 to 4 month incubator in Chile. The Chilean government provides you with 90%. You have to kind of like pay 10%. They cover 84 days of accommodation, basic salary, and the flights. Everything outside of that time, you have to cover yourself with your own funds. And you are not paid until 2 months into the project, which means that, and this is the big flaw that happened with a lot of the people over there, you have to have about $6,000 to $10,000 up front until you get it back. So Startup Chile was an incredible experience, and I'm so glad that I had the opportunity, simply because not just the office was amazing. I mean, you see the office space there. It was just absolutely gorgeous. Every day at 5 o'clock, there was the smell of fresh croissants, and you know, there was always coffee and tea, obviously, everywhere. International startups that we bonded with very, very quickly. And we even met one startup, which was in the same space as us. They were also working with geospatial augmented reality, but for air traffic control. So we had an opportunity to exchange research and, you know, to talk. It was just absolutely incredible. The way the weeks would kind of like go is we had 2 days workshops every 2 weeks. And so we had 12 days to do whatever we wanted, whether we chose to work from the office or, you know, work from home was totally up to us. The Chilean government had an allowance for Spanish lessons. They really tried to make it as comfortable and as nice as possible, because ultimately what the purpose of this incubator is to bring people over there to Chile to inspire local startups, but to also persuade you to stay.
Right, so as Mel said, the auditing was a nightmare. It took her an entire month at the end of Startup Chile, so the last month was auditing. Her first month was all spent doing paperwork and getting visas and getting all sorts of identification that she needed to just exist over there. So really, Mel got around about a month to actually work on the company itself. And it was around about this time that I actually started really getting stuck into trying to develop the product. So being the first commercial product and really the first complete project that I had worked on, at the start it was actually pretty straightforward. I knew what we needed, I knew the bones of what we needed to get it to work, to actually build an augmented reality world. So that part of it, while it, you know, took a while, I knew what I was doing. After that, it was pretty much the Wild West. I had no system in place, my planning was terrible, I had no development pipeline, I had no tools to help me. I really was just sort of picking bugs as I was going and trying to fix them and trying to make something better, and there wasn't a hell of a lot of planning. Around about this time, we also got, a few weeks into it, we got approached by a French intern or a French student who needed an internship to complete his studies. He was willing to come over and work for us for 6 months in return for accommodation. So we thought, why not? We don't have much to lose. We can certainly use his help, and he could learn a lot from us in terms of coming to Wellington with us to participate in the Accelerator Lightning Lab, which I think we'll get onto. I think the moral of the story here is that when you go into a startup environment, especially when you haven't done it before or when your development has been so structured that you all of a sudden need to do it all yourself, it can be... Well, I found it quite difficult to get a plan in place. But I spent a lot of time using different tools. I started with Trello, I moved on to Jira, and now I've got something that works quite nicely, and although it's just me and a few interns and a few contractors who help out, as soon as we need to expand, I now have those systems in place so that everything can be done streamlined and it can be done really efficiently and effectively.
So then we thought, what after S-Factory? We still need money. We still are not in a stage where we're going to start to make money. So what about another incubator? And we happened to hear about Lightning Lab XX, which is a female version. It's a female incubator, similar to S-Factory. The difference here is, first of all, that Lightning Lab obviously takes equity, but, you know, it provides a similar amount. But the thing was that I met with a ex-alumni while I was in Startup Chile, and I asked him, so what is Lightning Lab like? And he said, oh my God, it's nothing like Startup Chile, nothing at all. It is so intense. A lot of people probably think about dropping out within the first 5 weeks. It is so, so, so much more intense. Like, here you've got the freedom to choose when you want to work. Over there, you will hardly find time to work. So you really need to focus on your goal in order to achieve anything. So it sounded a little bit scary, and I kind of prepared Amy for it, and I said to her, look, this is what I've heard. Apparently, you know, this is going to be really, really full on. But nevertheless, you know, we decided to do it because the difference was also that S-Factory was a pre-accelerator to validate your idea. Lightning Lab XX was an accelerator to grow your idea. So that was another difference that we quite liked. And they were going to get us investor ready. And so we obviously didn't want to forever, you know, run on low cash. So getting investment was the next goal.
So did you go over this? I think
not much.
The Lightning Lab was pretty much the basic accelerator model that I talked to you about earlier. We got $20,000 of investment. It comes through in two tranches, so you get $10,000 at the start, $10,000 if you don't screw up or break their rules halfway through. They take 6%. They take 6% equity, and it's 4 months on site, and we were down in Wellington for the period of Lightning Lab.
Yeah, and so Lightning Lab, here we come, you know. Amy was there a week before me because literally it was a flying handover. By the time I left Chile, Lightning Lab was starting. And I just kind of like figured that I hadn't been home for, you know, over 3 months. I probably wanted just at least, you know, unpack my stuff and, you know, and say hi to my family before I head off again for another 3 months. And when we arrived there, oh my God, the guy had not been kidding. It was so intense. Like I remember, for instance, in the first week, you are introduced to about 70 mentors. Out of those 70 mentors, you have meetings with about 20. Out of those 20, you try to find your favorite five. And those favorite five are going to be one of those mentors that are seeing you through those 3 months and trying to help you build your startup. And this is actually the reason why we're here today, because one of our mentors was Terry Chapman from Microsoft, and he suggested that we talk. So the thing was that also, when you kind of like, you know, have so many mentors coming at you, the first 5 weeks is all about pivoting your idea. Everybody comes at you and says to you, so, you know, why are you working with kids? You should be working with adults, and you shouldn't be outdoor. You should be indoor. And in actual fact, have you ever thought about fitness studios? What about supermarkets? And you kind of like go, wow, this is incredible. Here's our vision mission statement, and everybody seems to be trying to push us away from the original idea that we've been working on for so long. So it was really frustrating, but what it actually did was that we dug our heels in the end after 5 weeks, and somebody, one of our mentors, advised us to listen back to what had us passionate, and we said, you know what? No. What we are going to do is we are going to get kids off the couch and active outside with mobile outdoor games. That is our vision mission statement. It's always been that. Forget everybody else. This is what we're doing. So after 5 weeks, it got a little bit easier. And our mentors were absolutely brilliant. Anything I forgot? I don't think so. So here comes the interesting part. So with that pivoting forwards and backwards, one of the challenges and issues that came up, and going back to Know Your Co-Founder, is that I hadn't quite understood how different Amy's and my belief system was. So you need to understand that for 20 years, I didn't only work on television shows, I also worked with advertising. So to me, the advertising world was quite normal. I was the CEO, so my job, is to find the money. And my belief system was that as a startup, I need to get the money no matter where from. But Amy is very ethical, she's got a really strong moral compass, and she kept us on course. And she said, I believe that we can create an ethical, clean brand without having to compromise our values. So she stood and really stood, you know, we had some serious conflicts there. You know, she really stood for saying, no, we're not allowing any advertisement in our games, we're not allowing any data mining, we will make sure that everything we are presenting is supported by parents. And so that goes down to, no, we're not accepting a contract with Coca-Cola or Pepsi. We're not advertising sugary brands. We're, in fact, everything that we're doing has to be for the best of children and families. And that has to be the underlying or the compass for what we're doing with the brand. And in the end, what we learned was that, and it really hit me when a friend of mine told me that. She said, you've worked on television. Has it never occurred to you to apply the same rules? Because in broadcast, you have the broadcasting standard for kids' television, which don't allow any advertisement. So we apply the same rules to gaming.
Yeah, so that was pretty much a great summary of our Lightning Lab experience. And as Lightning Lab was sort of drawing into its final month, we were sitting there looking at our cash reserves and wondering how much longer we would have to go. Now, even if you're successful at demo day and raising investment, it takes a while for that money to come through. There's due diligence, there's checking each other out, investors dropping in, dropping out. And it's normally a process of 3 months if you're lucky, and that's optimistic. So we knew that even if we were going to raise investment, we would need some money to tie us over between the end of Lightning Lab and whenever that money came in. And the solution for us was to run a Kickstarter. So we spent the last month of that, or the middle-ish of that Lightning Lab time to prepare and run a successful Kickstarter, which gave us enough money to keep working on the product and to sustain ourselves for those weeks after Lightning Lab money ran out.
Top reasons why founders fall out.
Co-founder fallout. So Mel and I are the two co-founders, that's it, it's just us. But neither of us has extensive experience in the gaming industry. I have played games, but I've never made them before. I've never been involved in the industry on any professional level. So we always had it in the back of our minds that we would like to bring on a third co-founder who had some experience in that industry. While we were at Lightning Lab, we found someone who we thought would be great, who we thought would be suitable. Unfortunately, in the end, it didn't work out due to reasons that were out of both of our control. But this raises a really important point that co-founder fallout is a real thing and it happens all the time. And we were warned about it going into Lightning Lab about how many teams would fall apart. We didn't believe it and we saw it and we're continuing to see it. Teams just falling apart all over the place. There's so much drama everywhere. And everything is so much more hyped when you're in a startup. Everything's so much more intense and it just, you know, escalates and arguments ensue and shit hits the fan. But there are three outstanding issues which seem to crop up time and time again. So the first of those is time. Being a startup co-founder eats your time. You have no time for anything else. Not in a bad way. You can always make it work for you, but you've got to be there. You've got to be on call for your company at all times. And some people just aren't prepared for that, and that's okay, but you can't then have other people relying on you as a co-founder. So the second one is financial. So I said earlier on, you need some money to start a startup, and if you can't finance it in some way, then a lot of people can't do it. They have families to support. There's a million reasons why you need to have a stable income, and as a startup, you won't necessarily have that. And the third one is just conflict. So that goes up to the emotions, that goes back to blowing up. Co-founder conflict, when you're spending so much time and so much time in each other's pockets, it's inevitable that that's going to happen, so manage it carefully.
Cool, demo day. So as Amy said earlier on, everything in Lightning Lab aims towards demo day, the final day where you package up all your reasons in 8 minutes why an investor should give you money. And that was a really interesting experience because that was where our journey started to talk for us to talk to angel investors. Do you want to talk about pitching games? Because that's really
pitching games.
Difficult.
Pitching games is not easy because investors expect you to have a formula for success. And if any of you have ever tried to make a game, there's not necessarily a great formula for success. And some games that are really crap take off, and some games that are friggin' awesome fail. And indie games, scene knows that more than any other industry. So investors tend to be quite shy about investing in games. You've got to be able to show a formula for success, and that's difficult. But apart from that, there are things that you can do. You can show that you've got a really strong team. So two co-founders is the minimum, but ideally you want more, so you've got a range of skills, and you've also got redundancy in there, so if somebody leaves or there's conflict, then the startup itself isn't going to fall over. I think there was,
so pitching games.
Team traction plan. Oh, well, that pretty much covers it. Team, you've got to have a good round of co-founders, traction. You've got to show that your product is wanted by someone. Games and entertainment, there's a relatively easy, well, not easy, but straightforward formula for entertainment. There's people always want to be entertained. You just need to be able to sell that really strongly as to why they will choose your entertainment over somebody else's. And you've got to have a plan for scaling. So it's no good if you've got this little game that If 100,000 people want to play, your server's going to fall over. You've got to have a plan for scale, because investors aren't interested if they can't make lots of money back. So I guess it's fine to have your little indie game and to do that as a hobby, but if there's no plan for scaling and high amounts of revenue, then investors won't be interested.
Yeah, and so as Amy said, basically what happens is that an angel investor is looking for a tenfold return of investment, and you need to tell them how you're going to achieve that. And so here I've written down a couple of reasons. So fact is, when you walk into the angel investor world, so first of all, you have to obviously tell, how are you going to create a tenfold return of investment. Then you need to find a lead investor who's going to lead the investment round, the money that you're trying to raise. And you will find that in New Zealand, you're actually ending up hackling over $5,000 to $10,000. It is pretty frustrating. So then you're walking into due diligence. Due diligence means that, say all the angel investors have said, yes, we want to invest. Somebody is going to go and look under the hood of your company if everything is tidy and if you actually can deliver what you said. Now, the thing is that if you don't pass that test, that's it. So you have to be absolutely prepared. You have to have done your homework. Otherwise, it's just not going to work. Now, what did we experience? Well, that was pretty interesting, because from the moment that we started pitching, the first thing we were told is oh, you're working with councils? Nah, not interested. Councils are slow. They have no business sense. Nah. And the second thing was, who in their right mind is going to run around outside with a device in front of their face? No one. And then Pokemon Go came out. And then all of a sudden, the investors changed their tune and said, all right, tell us we were wrong. But the councils were still an issue. And so one of the things that happened was we were invited to Angel at my table. So one of the opportunities that come up after the incubator is that you're invited to loads and loads and loads of opportunities to pitch your idea. So Angel at my table is a little social little get-together where you have 5 minutes to pitch your idea to three judge investors who give you their reasons why they give you money or whatever, and you can win a little bit of the money for those $5,000. Well, on that day, we were actually the backup team. We weren't supposed to pitch at all. And at some stage, they came up to us and they said, can you just walk up and do a one-minute pitch? I said, yeah, sure. So we did our one-minute pitch, and the judges said to us, we would have happily given you the entire money. We're going to give you second prize. So we walked away with the second biggest prize on the night. But again, the comment of, if you weren't working with councils, we would invest in you. And we're like, Dad, where do you want us to get the money from? This is our validated idea where we're actually getting cash from. So that doesn't work for us. So let's talk about some other startup ideas, other incubator ideas.
Yeah, so I guess the moral of the story is that we had an idea and we wanted to make it work, and accelerators were the way that we could make it work, and it's the way that a lot of you can make a startup work if that's what you want to do. There are, as I said earlier, tons of accelerators out there. We did Lightning Lab, a more traditional one. There's something else called SODA, so that's a model where they pair you up with mentors, and they actually have quite an intensive and boutique way of approaching it that's tailored to your business rather than a one-size-fits-all approach, which is more like what Lightning Lab did. There are heaps of different options in different industries as well, so depending on what your idea is, there will be some incubators which are more suited for your industry or whichever industry you're trying to go into. I think the New Zealand one that's just starting now, they're looking for applications. It's a fintech one. I think it's a financial tech incubator, and that's being run by Creative HQ, who are the same people that ran Lightning Lab.
One of the other things that I just forgot to mention earlier on is, so along our journey, we ended up in China, or I ended up in China, and with an organization called Funda Tech. And that was really interesting. We were the first batch of startups they took to China. And over there, they're doing business with a big investment group, and we're talking Chinese investors that have got $100 million in cash, pocket money. So we went over there, and just to give you a rough idea as to how much that cost, because that was the thing that blew me away, I paid $2,900 plus GST, 4 flights, 5-star accommodation for a week, all the traveling, 3 times food, superfood, seriously, all to China. And we did we pitched in Chengdu and we pitched in Chongqing. Everything was taken care of to the extent that when I arrived, my credit cards wouldn't work. I couldn't withdraw any money. And so the entire week, I had not a single cent of cash, and I didn't need it. I absolutely didn't need it. Everything was covered. It was the most amazing trip. What did I learn from that trip? It was a real big eye-opener. It was nothing like what I expected. I think if you have a product and you're considering the Chinese market to go over there, I would advise you to kind of like think about it this way. You need to have a product that the Chinese market can straight away distribute, where they just maybe have to change the packaging or, you know, do a translation and then it will work. You also need to take into account that Google over there doesn't work. So you need to find a different way, you know, whatever it is, do your homework as to whether you're using anything that won't work in China. And the Chinese market is very, very keen on products from the Western world, but they seem to be not as much lateral thinkers as we are. So they're very good in looking at something and, you know, following a real intense brief, versus what I found is that when we said, you can use our technology for other things, you don't just have to use it for gaming in a park and creating digital playgrounds. You could kind of like use it for architecture, you could use it for education, or you could use it for tourism. You know, there are so many different applications. And I actually found that they didn't seem to be quite as good as imagining what that meant. Everything needed to have a real application that they could test and understand. So that was really interesting for me. So nevertheless, we are obviously now working with a couple of leads from China. And guess what? The Chinese market, they really liked that we're working with councils. Isn't that funny? So yes. That was really, really amazing. Now, if any of you guys ever have to do a presentation in Chinese, in the Chinese market, I just want to leave you with a couple of notes on there. You have to kind of like appreciate that the translator has a really hard time translating from English into Chinese. And unless you speak at a really slow rate and phrase your words as it was for a 10-year-old, there may come a different translation out at the other end. And so we had a couple of Chinese startup presentations translated to us in English. I can tell you half of them, I was kind of sitting there and going, what the heck is he talking about? So yeah, please keep that in mind, you know, and keep it simple. So we're almost at the end, and I guess the big question now is where to from here? We're at a very, very exciting crossroad, and I want to bring it back to Pokemon Go. The reason why Pokemon Go has been so successful is because they're paired with a very popular brand. At this point in time, we are doing the same thing. So we're currently negotiating with another big company, and we're looking at signing exclusive territorial contracts for English-speaking countries, where we will also look into partnering with big popular kids brands. And we have found that there's a number of very big companies already out there who are very excited by what we're doing and who love what a different type of entertainment format this is. We are not just doing a new form of entertainment, we've also opened a completely new different marketing channel because we are actually working with communities. So if you go back to Magical Park and the concept, councils are subscribing to our playgrounds, but the community gets to play for free. And you know what? That actually works the best in poor areas. Isn't that interesting? Because it's free entertainment for the kids, and it's fun. It keeps them running around. Our games keeping the kids entertained for, you know, 30 minutes at least, and having them running around. So it's absolutely brilliant. So we're very excited about the new partnerships that we're about to move into. And maybe next year, you know, we have the opportunity to tell you all about our lessons learned from licensing agreements and what have you. We're currently rolling out Magical Park throughout New Zealand, and we've got the first parks, or the first companies interested in England now to roll out as well. So before we're kind of like going to questions, I thought I'm going to give you a little bit of a, not a preview because it's actually live right now, but we're doing event-based little games. This is the one that's live at the moment. Thank you. Fabulous. So thank you very much. If you have any questions, now is probably the time. Or not. Thank you.
Yeah, I think there was one.
There was a question. For the incubators? Okay. Well, the interesting thing is, so if an incubator gets 6% equity, then you're obviously looking at, you know, maybe a cohort of 10 startups, and they're banking on the fact that at least one of them is going to make good money, and maybe two or three are going to make the investment back of that they've spent on all of them. So that's the idea from the accelerators. Yeah, that's right. So even after the incubator, they will look after you really well. They will try and help you with media coverage. They will put you in touch with other mentors, other advisors, other people that have walked that path before you. I cannot tell you how many people we have been introduced to through our incubator, including the partner that we're currently negotiating our contract with. So, you know, it's not just the money, it's not just the advice during the 3 months, it carries on after that. There is no stop, and even with Startup Chile, we're still in touch, they're following what we're doing, and whenever we want to kind of like do anything overseas, we just need to reach out because they have a huge international network. Any other questions?
Some of them are, some of them we've contracted, but what you've seen there is mostly bought off the asset store. We literally don't, I mean, I can't model, I can't animate, and we don't have the bandwidth. So at the moment, the stuff suffices, but we will definitely, and especially when we start partnering with content providers, we'll get content from them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, basically, as we've moved into partnerships, what we've actually found is that they have embraced it, saying that they think it will make it a stronger exit at the end. Remember, every startup also has an exit plan, so that when the time comes for us to exit, that it will actually make the exit stronger. And because we are very clear that we're having an ethical standard, the councils like us more. They are actually supporting us more. And we found that with every partner that we've talked to, they embrace it. They really like it. It is part of what created for us a very trusting relationship. And I seriously have to give all the credit to Amy for that, because she was right. She was right in the sense that if you do not cut corners, in the longer run, in the longer view, it creates a brand that has got so much more to give and so much more credibility than if you just kind of like trying to look, where can I get the fastest way? What's the fastest way for me to get some money in? And that actually costs you credibility. You look at the criticism that Pokemon Go got in a lot of ways. We did whatever we could to avoid that, and that's the reason why we had some really, really positive press. Any other questions? Yeah, hang on, there's two over there. Absolutely, yeah. So we're basically, we've started to get the first orders in before the trial with Magical Park in New Zealand ended. And we've got already first councils on the book, with every day more coming in, which is really cool. Yeah. See, this is really interesting, because I think sometimes ignorance is bliss. And what I mean by that is that when I started working with the councils, I had no idea that there was a process. I had no idea that we were supposed to follow a certain way of working with councils. What I actually ended up doing was rocking up and saying, hey, this is what we're doing. Do you want to give it a go? We started off with a massive price tag, and we realized it wasn't working because the investors said to us, you know, like, we don't like that you're working with councils. We did something that was unheard of. We set the councils we were working with in a room, and we actually said to them, we want you guys to have a conversation. and tell us what is a good price point for us. What do you want from us? So you go away, you talk, and you come back to us. And you think about it as, you know, that you are the investor. And they came back to us and they said to us, you know, like, look, we are happily subscribing if you can kind of get it down to $2,500 a year per park. So the councils dictated the price. And what that did was we bypassed a hell of a lot of trouble. I remember that Auckland Council asked me in to for a consultation job. And the first question I got is, how did you manage to become a council vendor? And I was like, are we? It's like, what do you mean? You don't know. It's like, no. Do you have to be a vendor to work with the council? It's like, yes. It's like, ah, guess we didn't realize that. So it was really that ignorant, you know. And what happened was that the councils, especially the Wellington Council, they are actually mentoring us. No, park management. Yeah. And at this point, I should also notice that, or mention that, so from that council meeting, what also came from that is that there is an organization in New Zealand called NZRA, New Zealand Recreation Association. They are now a partnership with us. And they were very much put forward by the councils as the trusting entity that would understand park management, that had already all the sales strategies and everything, you know, like all the contacts, and they are now managing the marketing and the sales for us in New Zealand. And we're about to strike a similar deal for the rest of the world. Cool. Any? Yeah? Sorry, can you kind of rephrase that question a little bit? Mm-hmm. Oh, right, you mean like, you know, reducing the size?
Yeah, so we've been talking with Doc about that kind of app, and I think there's a huge potential to move into that area. And especially education about native flora and fauna, and this kind of technology is going to be incorporated into educational curriculum, I have no doubt.
Yeah. Schools are very much endorsing us, they like us. So, any more questions? Yeah?
How do you protect yourself
if kids injuring themselves while they're playing?
Yeah.
In the 4 years that we've now done research, we've not had one injury. Not once.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, in New Zealand, we're kind of safe with ACC. The States is a whole other ball game. We're getting advice. I've got a bit of a legal background, so I'm sort of taking care of it, but we will get indemnity insurance for the States, for sure. and the UK.
Yeah.
Anywhere that doesn't have ACC, and anywhere international.
Yeah. And yeah, serious terms and conditions, obviously, that literally, you know, hand over all responsibility.
Liable for nothing.
That's right. But we also make sure that we are making it very clear that this is not a babysitter, you know, so that parents are not falling in this trap of thinking, I just give my child, you know, a device and that's the babysitter and I don't have to worry about anything. That's not the idea. Any more questions? Yeah.
Haven't, but it's crossed. We have had discussions about how we can get the technology into the hands of people who don't necessarily have it or have access to it.
Yeah.
At this stage, it's too complicated for us to invest into. But if somebody came and wanted to do that, I think we would. It's within our, you know, framework of.
There are some council models that I might kind of, you know, make you aware of, which HUT Council is playing with. So HUT Council in the Wellington region, they have a coding club. And they also have a really amazing library, which, so if you think about Hutt not necessarily being the most, the richest area, right? What they're doing is, just like kids are able to rent maybe a basketball to go out and play, they are looking at renting out devices. And what they find is that the kids are actually really responsible with it. And so they rent a device, there's a playground right next door, which is Avalon Park, they get to play, and then they bring it back. So this is a model that we have been investigating, and we're looking at, you know, what are devices that would suit. So we have actually been working already with the Coding Club. They have their own devices. That's pretty much the low end of the spectrum, where we need to kind of like, you know, consider that none of those tablets have got SIM cards, so they're all Wi-Fi based. Now, in the Wellington region, they have an amazing public Wi-Fi network. Not every park has that, but it is something that's being rolled out more and more, and we know that a lot of, you know, like Spark and Vodafone and whatever, you know, like definitely looking at things like that. So there are other ways where the councils are trying to take advantage of what we're doing, because of the fact that they've realized that this gives the community, especially the poorer community, access to something they normally wouldn't have. And it is actually educational. It's seen as very positive, especially because we found that on average, kids, when they're playing our games, they run between 500 meters and 2 kilometers in one session. So, you know, that's better than nothing. That's better than sitting on the couch. So, yeah, you know, that's the closest as where we're at the moment. We've had previous prototypes. I don't know whether some of you guys are aware of the Moa Park in Otorohanga. So we were looking, this project is on hold at the moment, but there is very much the thought of having tablets that are being rented out, and then, you know, people can go and treat it like an adventure park. To be honest, there are, like, every day we're getting new parks signed up, and so at this point in time we're catching up with signing them up. Auckland is just in the state of re-evaluating which parks they want to have activated. So they had 9 parks activated. They want quite a few more. So we'll see, you know, like how many are coming on. So at this point in time, right now, there is 3 parks active in New Zealand, and we have quite a few orders waiting to switch them live. And the biggest park for us is to kind of go and assess each park and make sure that those parks are safe, that we approve, and then it's the park signs, some, you know, printed, installed, all of that stuff needs to be done. So our trial is only finished on the 10th of September, and so we're literally right now communicating with all the councils, coming to us every single day with satellite pictures of parks and, you know, assessing them and trying to see, okay, which one is actually a good area so they're having a good experience.
Yeah, so we advise to have an area clear of obstacles, including trees and holes and water.
So, you know, for instance, our Tia Square is not a good section, is not a good area to play the game, A, because there are steps, and even, like, you know, we tested there one stage and I almost fell down the steps. So, you know, and if you drop the device, then it's more likely to break. We are really trying to stick to a sports field or an open plain park, where the risk is as minimal as possible that anything can happen. And you will find that we're by now a very mixed culture society, and some cultures are more worried about, you know, the kids injuring themselves than others. So we are really, this goes all back to safety. We're really trying to kind of, you know, keep everybody happy so that they're not worried, you know, if they're showing up with 3 kids and there's a couple of, you know, like toddlers around, that they're walking off into the pond while the 6-year-old is kind of like playing. So things like that. We're really trying to be conscious of that.
Yeah, it's come up. Councils have raised that very issue, switching off at night, not so much for safety playing in the dark, but for safety playing around unsavoury characters. And that's something we're still negotiating with individual councils.
Yeah.
But I think that's our time. But if anyone has any other questions, feel free to come up and grab us, and we're happy to chat.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
How many times can I man? Watch the sun rise over his head without feeling free.